For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Organizers are planning a theatrical protest at this Monday's City Council meeting, and it's all about water. The Sierra Club's Falls of the James, along with the All Saints Theater Company, plan to protest outside City Hall to speak against the City of Richmond's minimum service charge for water, which is currently the highest in the nation. An online petition calling for a lowering of the fee currently has 1,300 signatures, and protest planners hope to draw at least some of their supporters to the gathering. This is the most regressive means possible to raise general funds for the city, putting an outrageous service charge on the most basic necessity, says organizer Scott Berger. For more, go to the Open Source RVA Facebook page and listen to podcasts of interviews with those on both sides of the water rates issue. There's a new grocery shopping option in town. Upscale chain The Fresh Market, located at 10 North Nansemond at Carytown Place, opened its doors this Wednesday morning. But not all Richmond residents will be able to shop at the new store, as Style Weekly reported this week. The Fresh Market appears to be the one metro area grocery store that will not take food stamps. Consumers wishing to use payments from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, or the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, known as WIC, will have to go elsewhere. Virginia Department of Social Services statistics show that almost 30,000 local households participated in SNAP just in July of this year. Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia, Claire Guthrie Gastaniaga, told Style that the Fresh Market is saying to a whole class of people, working poor, military families, we don't want your business. Fresh Market spokesperson Drury Sackett countered that this is a company-wide policy and that the chain is updating its systems to accept these forms of payment, but there is no specific timeline. Star relays that Mayor Dwight Jones is interested in having a conversation with the store on the subject, according to his press secretary, Tammy Hawley, and is open to an alternative approach, especially in light of city demographics. USDA data show there are 12 food deserts in the metro area alone, representing 23,000 Richmonders with limited access to healthy, affordable food, while the Fresh Market makes the fourth grocery store concentrated within a few Carytown blocks. In a recent email sent to supporters, former Virginia Tea Party Patriots Chair Jamie Ratke newly endorsed her former rival George Allen. Ratke, who lost the Virginia GOP primary for the 2012 Senate race, admits she has been a harsh critic of what she cites as Allen's past record of spending and debt. Ratke's endorsement is explained as dependent on whether Allen would show his commitment to fixing the U.S. financial crisis, in this case, a documented plan of spending cuts and debt reduction, and the publicizing of this plan as part of his senatorial campaign. The George Allen blueprint for reining in and restoring fiscal discipline to the federal government proposes many familiar Republican suggestions, such as capping spending, ending earmarks, freezing federal hiring, and restructuring social safety net programs. The plan also touts limits on federal regulation to the American Energy Freedom Act, the RAINS Act, and a Freedom to Work agenda, all of which would affect protections for the environment and the labor force, among other currently safeguarded areas. In a recent email sent to supporters, former Virginia Tea Party Patriots Chair Jamie Ratke newly endorsed her former rival George Allen. Ratke, who lost the Virginia GOP primary for the 2012 Senate race, admits she has been a harsh critic of what she cites as Allen's past record of spending and debt. Ratke's endorsement is explained as dependent on whether Allen would show his commitment to fixing the U.S. financial crisis, in this case, a documented plan of spending cuts and debt reduction, and the publicizing of this plan as part of his senatorial campaign. The George Allen blueprint for reining in and restoring fiscal discipline to the federal government proposes many familiar Republican suggestions, such as capping spending, ending earmarks, freezing federal hiring, and restructuring social safety net programs. The plan also touts limits on federal regulation to the American Energy Freedom Act, the RAINS Act, and a Freedom to Work agenda, all of which would affect protections for the environment and the labor force, among other currently safeguarded areas. If you're at a loss for weekend activities, why not check out My Heart is an Idiot, Found Magazine's 10th anniversary tour. Brothers Davey and Pete Rothbart will enchant you with selections from Davey's recently published book of essays, My Heart is an Idiot, Peter's strange and wonderful songs based on found notes, and further serendipitous fun. Find something fascinating this Sunday, September 23rd, 8 p.m. at Firehouse Theater Project. The $5 for the tickets benefit Books on Wheels, which provides free books and bike repair to underprivileged communities in RVA and around the country.
This month has not been easy for Virginia pro-choice proponents who'd rallied for the past 2 years against potentially landscape-altering abortion clinic legislation, only to have their efforts rebuffed during an emotional vote by the state health board. That legislation, called TRAP, to hear the pro-life side, is simply about enforcing regulations to ensure the safety and welfare of women. But perhaps tellingly, many who support the regulations belong to organizations with the stated goal of outlawing abortion. Last week, Open Source heard from Victoria Cobb, president of the Family Foundation of Virginia, on why these new laws, passed the same day our program aired, were necessary. She avowed a belief that the rules, which focus heavily on issues of strict building codes, would not harm Virginia's abortion clinics. Pro-choice advocates find little comfort in that assurance. I'm here with Scott Price, a co-founder of the Alliance for Progressive Values, a lobbying group whose founding was inspired in part by the TRAP laws, and Christine Daw, Deputy Director for Women's Rights Issues with the APV. She's a former Planned Parenthood volunteer. So we heard last week that these rules will change very little other than improving safety. In your opinion, what do these rules mean?
Well, I would say that that's not the case. We think these rules are going to have a devastating effect on women's reproductive health in Virginia. The TRAP regulations, the targeted regulations against abortion providers, they were designed from their outset to make it incredibly difficult for women to get access to a legal and safe procedure here in the state. And what we saw with the Board of Health was that the important parts of the legislature as far as doing that, which were the architectural regulations, that was what they wanted to preserve. And they wanted those to apply to all clinics so that they could have the effect that they were designed to have, which was to force clinics out of business.
Now, tell me a little bit, the architectural regulations, why in particular are those so odious?
They require every women's health clinic that performs more than 5 abortions in the course of a month to basically operate as a hospital. They're going to have to do all sorts of medically unnecessary architectural and structural redesign, in some cases literally having to rebuild buildings because they require halls to be as large as halls are in hospitals. They require all manner of equipment that is honestly not used or needed in a general clinic practice.
Now, we heard last week from Victoria Cobb, who's with the Family Foundation, and she explained to us that these regulations would be the sorts of things that just are about preserving safety of women, that this is not about trying to ban abortion or to get rid of abortion or to regulate out abortion. Is there any estimate at this point from pro-choice folks on how many of our state's abortion clinics are sort of threatened, I suppose, by these regulations? Or is it too early to tell?
It's too early to tell. Certainly the majority of them. Virginia has something on the order of 20 to 22 clinics, depending on how it's defined. The statistics I saw said that approximately 17 of those would have to close down.
And that's of 21? Is that right?
I think so. I've heard the number anything from 20 to 22, so let's cut it at 21.
Okay.
I think it depends on how you define it.
Okay. And I guess when we were talking earlier, you were talking about the fact that some of this, again, has come down to, again, these architectural and other regulatory measures on these clinics, and how at some point during this process there was some talk of not just these clinics being regulated, but more broadly, these being applied to medical clinics, dental clinics, et cetera, et cetera. Are you opposed to regulation of clinics?
Nobody opposes regulations that are meant to enhance people's safety. That's what medicine is all about, is saving lives. But the problem with these regulations is that even though its proponents are operating under the guise that that's what it's for, it's really not. It's about shutting down abortion clinics, which is especially devastating to women in rural areas who may not have a clinic already. So
now that was one of the interesting things coming out of the vote last Friday. I believe it was maybe one of the board members said that, well, you know, that argument didn't fly for them because women in rural areas could still go someplace else and get an abortion. It doesn't change any.
I think that's disingenuous. Yeah. I think one of the points we want to make is that when you look at TRAP and when you look at this legislation, you can't. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's part of a wider attack on women's reproductive rights and on women's rights across the board. If you get rid of the clinics in the southwest part of the state, and there aren't that many to begin with, then women in that part of the state who want to get reproductive services are going to have to travel. But then couple that with the fact that we've passed legislation this year as part of the ultrasound bill, the mandatory ultrasound bill, we've passed legislation there that requires an additional 24-hour waiting period. And now for poor women, for women who can't get child care and all, we're talking about a situation where they may have to take days out of their life to get a legal and safe procedure. There's an effort here that it's cumulative to make it more and more difficult for women.
Now, it gets more expensive too, right, with the ultrasound bill?
Very much so.
Yeah, you know, ultrasounds can be upwards of $1,000, so you have this medically unnecessary procedure tacked on top of one that doesn't need it, you know, and that can, especially for women coming from rural areas who may not be as, you know, economically well off, they already have to travel, they don't have that time, they don't have that money, so they're being punished because of these regulations.
To a greater extent than somebody in
definitely.
An urban. Or, I guess, near a state border.
Yeah, I mean, you know, their statistics, I think it's something on the order of 87% of the counties in the United States don't have access to a reproductive clinic. And that number can go up to 97%, I think, if you take out the urban centers. So, you know, I mean, there'll probably still be a clinic in Richmond, and there'll probably still be a clinic in Northern Virginia, and maybe one in Norfolk and so on. But for a large portion of the population, we're talking about a really difficult set of parameters that they'll have to meet to be able to get a legal and safe, you know, medical procedure that is, you know, safer than plastic surgery. It's safer than LASIK. It's safer than, you know, oral dental surgery.
Now, are we regulating above and beyond those?
Oddly, we're not.
Yeah, we thought that was the interesting thing, that if, you know, nobody is, like I said, nobody is opposed to regulations that make medical procedures safer for people. But if that is our ultimate goal, then why aren't we regulating dentists? Why aren't we regulating other outpatient procedures where you can go and get a biopsy? You know, abortion has kind of been put in this corner where it's its own thing.
Are these other types of clinics not regulated, is what you're saying, to the same extent with the architectural and the inspections,
no.
Et cetera.
Right.
No, I mean, outpatient clinics are regulated. I mean,
of course.
And this is one of the fallacies, that the abortion clinics aren't regulated. They are regulated. There are federal regulations or state regulations that deal with clinics. These regulations were designed specifically for abortion clinics because that's what they wanted to get rid of.
And that's where, again, you have these architectural and zoning regulations that come into play. You had talked a little bit before we came on about abortion being one of the safest medical procedures in terms of record. That was an interesting argument that Victoria made last week, was that there had been this death in Northern Virginia about 10 years ago. And I think I had asked her about the lack of data that was able to be provided related to injury caused by abortions. Is there data that would indicate that additional regulations are more necessary in women's clinics than in other?
Absolutely not. You know, like I said, abortion is definitely one of the safest procedures. I think that many of the proponents of these TRAP regulations were kind of painting this macabre scene of these abortion clinics looking like horror films. And, you know, death has been estimated to occur in only one of 160,000 cases, which, you know, you're a lot more likely to go outside and get struck by a car. You're getting in the realm of lightning strikes.
Do you
at
have
this
any
point.
Comparable statistics for other procedures, or I mean, how common are I guess deaths?
I don't, but I will say that I'm confident in saying that abortion is one of the safest outpatient procedures you can get.
Now, and you were, I believe you were saying this before the show, that there's some information from the CDC or.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's some information out there. What I would point out is that there's an enormous amount of disinformation out there as well. And the other side traffics in that on a fairly regular basis. what you'll hear is that abortion causes breast cancer, that abortion causes women to commit suicide, that abortion causes women to be infertile, that abortion causes lifelong depression, and it muddies the waters and it makes it much more difficult for women to make good decisions.
Now, are you familiar with trap-style laws in other states? Is this a pattern?
Yeah, I think it's definitely part of a pattern that has rightfully been called the war against women. I believe it's around 34 states have trap-like regulations for abortion clinics, so this is nothing new.
How new is the trap, tactic?
It's been going on. It's fairly recent. A lot of a lot of this is coming from what they see one state do successfully, other states are copying. But I will say that it is in the last 2 years that the real aggressive assault on women's reproductive rights has been so strong.
Now, forgive me, isn't there? And I've forgotten the name of this, but there's a alleged, I guess, bill sharing organization that's a
yeah, that's ALEC.
Is ALEC at all involved in promoting trap legislation, or is this?
They have tended to be more business oriented.
Okay.
But I would not necessarily say that's not the case. I can't speak one way or the other to that.
Okay. Did you guys? I know APV, I guess, is too late on the scene to have been involved in the early part of this when the law was going through the legislature. But were there efforts to come to some sort of a compromise with the Family Foundation, as Victoria had talked about, that they had put forward much more limited regulatory requirements? And
I'm not aware of that. What I saw at the General Assembly in 2011 on the last day was some fairly sneaky, underhanded maneuvering to tack on really radical language to what had been a fairly vanilla clinics bill. If there was offers of other outcomes, I didn't hear about that. Now, why would I necessarily? They don't necessarily come to me with their discussions. But I would say this, is that if they were so open to compromise, then why weren't they comfortable with what happened in June when the Board of Health came up with what we felt was a reasonable, common-sense compromise to grandfather in the existing clinics. And they made it a point of not wanting that. The Attorney General, the governor came back and threatened and bullied because the one requirement they wanted was the architectural ruling, because that's what they're going to use to put these clinics out of business.
Now, why, as I understand, usually when you do something like require new code for most construction, it's future alterations to the property that will still trigger those requirements. So if I add an addition to my house or something, I have to, instead of having my three-pronged receptacle plugs facing one way, I have to turn them upside down now or whatever, and that's a new reg. So I have to bring all that up to code. Presumably, with the 21 clinics, had they decided to expand or to do improvements internally, they probably would have at that point had to have come up to the code?
Yes, yeah. I believe so.
Okay. And why would I guess the grandfathering have been an acceptable compromise in your view?
Yeah. Why would we have thought it was acceptable?
I'm assuming it's because you're looking at new clinics. As new clinics come online, it's a little bit easier to do the work up to the current code requirement.
Well, one, we believe the regulations were unnecessary to begin with. So if you're going to have these onerous regulations, at least allow the clinics that have been operating in the state successfully and safely for decades, why not allow them to continue rather than to put this onerous, massive financial burden on them, which is designed to put them out of business?
So I guess the the next to last question is, what happens now? Where does the war take us next?
Well, the radicals control the General Assembly. They control the administration.
Now, when you say radicals, I'm sorry.
The radicals, conservatives, who have an agenda which last year included a personhood bill that would have gotten rid of women's access to certain kinds of birth control, bills that would have had women drug tested who were on TANF, bills that would have removed Medicare access.
TANF, real quick again, is basically welfare as we used to know it.
There's no such thing as welfare. Welfare was eliminated during the Clinton administration. when they talk about welfare, it doesn't exist. TANF is aid to needy families.
Needy families.
These are single parent families, women with small children. This is not welfare. This is not.
But it's things like WIC, what used to be known as
WIC,
food stamps,
and food stamps is a big part of this.
So you're leaning these requirements towards people who are least likely to be able to afford to protest.
Well, and it's also a way of criminalizing poverty. I mean, so many of these things are punitive specifically to people who are poor. But, I mean, we'll see that kind of legislation again this year. We'll see more of it. And let me also point out that this time Governor McDonald is not trying to look good on national television and get a vice presidential nod. So he's free to follow his inclinations, which we saw with the Board of Health when he and his attorney general bullied them into doing this by basically threatening them in the sense that if there was a lawsuit, which I'm sure our friends in the Family Foundation were prepared to file, that they would then not have the benefit of the attorney general.
So you expect to see an upping of the volume. So
it's going to be worse.
Yeah.
How badly did this set you guys back on your heels?
Oh, we took a punch. You know, I mean, we took a big punch. But let me also say, we got knocked for a loop last Friday. But that punch was thrown 2 years ago. And in the 2 years since that happened, we have been organizing at a level that just hasn't existed before. I honestly was not particularly political before this. Most of the people in APV this is the first time they've been involved with any kind of lobbying and any kind of civic engagement and things like that. And that's because of these radical activities. And I think that we were in while we're taking it on the chin right now, we're going to be in a much better position to fight. It's a fight that will take time, but we're here for the long run.
Christine, as the deputy director for human rights issues, what sort of agenda are you guys setting at this point?
We definitely want to continue to fight against these regulations, and I'm sure that there will be all sorts of new legislation trying to pass in the General Assembly that's along these same lines, and that criminalizes not only poverty but also women for basically being women. So we're definitely going to do a lot of work with that, and we will also be on the lookout because, like I said, the National War on Women is definitely a big part of it is the reproductive rights, but it's not everything. You have people who are opposed to the Violence Against Women Act, which would protect domestic violence, people against the equal pay for equal work for women. So, you know, these are not, like Scott said, in a vacuum.
Do those issues overlap with these groups that have pushed this legislation?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting to me that these people are talking about safety and equal rights for women in terms of protecting them with these regulations. But these are the very same people who have opposed the Lilly Ledbetter Act that would make sure women were paid for their fair share of work. So it's just It's a very interesting contrast, and they say they're protecting women, but really they don't seem to be.
Thank you again to Scott Price Christine Dawes. You're both with it, the APV, Alliance for Progressive Values, for coming in today and talking today a little bit about the trap laws that go into effect in the next couple of years, I guess.
There's a process. There's still, I think, the public comment period and so on and so forth, but they have effectively moved forward. I will say that we'll see, you know, we don't have the wherewithal, but we'll see if there aren't some court cases involved with this. There are some questions, for instance, about passing regulations that are designed to put people out of business, which some of these, you know, independent clinic owners definitely are. So, I mean, we're going to keep after it. And one of the things, you know, well, this has been
that's an irony as well, isn't it?
I guess
that you're talking about now. It's the right to do business.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, it's fascinating how government intrusion is terrifying when it's, you know, how many firearms you can buy in the course of an afternoon, but it's not a problem when we, you know, are basically looking and, you know, wanting to get control of women's uteruses.
All right. Well, Christine Daw and, again, Scott Price with
Thanks
the
so
APV.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're back with Open Source RVA. I'm Don Harrison, and we are raising money for WRIR. Give us a call, or you can go online, WRIR.org. You can give there. And we want to thank all of the great people that have been giving. Nancy, Sean, Emily, Bill, Virginia, Adam. And I'm told that we are at $475 for this slot. And we're $25 away from our $500 goal before 5 p.m. So now's the time. Give us a call. 622-9747. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission returned recently to North Anna for re-inspection of the North Anna Nuclear Power Plant. The fact is, the plant was built on a mostly but not always inactive fault line. Erica Gray with the Coalition Against Nukes has spent the week in D.C. for a special event on the on a nuclear-free future, and we have Erica here right now to speak with us today on Open Source RVA. Thanks for coming, Erica.
Thanks for having me, Don. I think it's very important to support independent radio stations like WRIR to stay informed.
Well, thank you so much for that. Yeah. Why would conditions at North Anna be of such concern?
Well, I guess we can start off with it's an aging, older plant. And as like you mentioned earlier, it was built on a fault line. Actually, it was knowingly built on a fault line, knew there was a fault line there. Perhaps they thought it wasn't active at the time. But when we had our 5.8 earthquake, the motion exceeded the plant's design.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's pretty important. They did a bunch of walk-downs, but at the time, Beyond Nuclear and Virginia Sierra Club, not on our fault line, and APV filed an emergency petition, an enforcement petition, because they didn't want to check both reactors. They only wanted to check one. And we also found out there was missing seismic sensors that should have been located there.
Well, tell me a little about the event that's going on this weekend in Washington, D.C.
Well, what's going on is we're right in the middle of 3 days of events in D.C. Coalition Against Nukes has scheduled events for all 3 days. I got back from yesterday's events. This started off with a rally at the Capitol Reflecting Pool that happened prior to going over to the Cannon Building on Capitol Hill for the congressional briefing that was hosted by Dennis Kucinich. And a lot of the speakers that were there were experts in the field, including Arnie Gernison from Fairwinds & Associates, as a nuclear engineer.
If anyone wanted some more information on what you're doing, where would they go?
You can go to coalitionagainstnukes.org.
Great, great. Well, thanks for coming in today and speaking with us on Open Source RVA. It should be said that we'll be having you back in for a more extensive interview in the future. So this is a little preview.
Thank you very much, Don.
Stop and let this sink in for a minute. The Richmond Folk Festival is the most popular and well-attended festival of its kind in America. Last year's offering enjoyed record crowds, and visitors to the free event were treated to nearly two dozen world-class performers spread over seven stages along Richmond's waterfront. The fifth installment is slated for October 12th through the 14th, and like every year, the challenge will be to see how many of these great artists that one can catch in a single weekend's time. To help Open Source RVA navigate this massive event, we've got four festival veterans, planners, and thinkers here to tell us what to listen out for at the fifth annual Richmond Folk Festival. Joining me today is Lisa Sims and Stephen Leckie of Venture Richmond, which works to put the festival on each year. Jim Warwick is here, too. He's a former publisher of Style Weekly, on the board of the Virginia Center for the Public Press, and chairman of the Folk Festival's local programming committee. Lisa and Stephen are on that committee, too, as is my fourth guest, Chris Bopst, columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch and a local music booker and DJ. And I should say, for full disclosure, that I, too, sit on the festival's local programming committee with these fine folks, so all journalistic integrity flies out the window right here. Welcome, everybody, to Open Source RVA.
Thanks, Don.
Thanks, Don. Thank you.
First off, let's do a real quick look back at last year's festival. I'm going to go around the room. Lisa Sims first. What was your favorite thing about the 2011 festival that will always stick with you?
Other than 200,000 people making it the largest folk festival in the country.
Well, that might count.
Yeah. Other than that, Pedrito Martinez, I think, which just an amazing Afro-Cuban group that, if you go to New York, you know to go and see them. We were delighted to bring them in, and they were just incredibly energetic, and they were my favorite group, I think.
Yeah, they were hot. Stephen, what was your...
I'd say my two highlights were the carnival costumes that were in the Virginia Folklife area at Tredegar were absolutely amazing and stunning and huge and just unbelievable to think folks actually wear those costumes. And Basiku Coyote, pronouncing that correctly.
That was my favorite as well, yes.
On the dance stage Saturday night.
Malian dance music.
Yeah, had everyone sort of entranced and just grooving. It was very cool.
Jim?
Well, I've been lucky enough to be on the programming committee since the beginning, and I think within the first hour of the first meeting, I wanted to talk about doo-wop music.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us it took us 7 years,
right.
But Larry Chance and the Earls, they just killed me. It was real doo-wop, the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
And patience is a virtue there.
Yes, well, so is persistence.
Chris Bopes, what was your favorite thing about the 2011 festival?
Well, I like all of it, which is probably... a dumb answer to give, right? Original P after, and this is always a problem with the Folk Festival every year. People are like, what do you want to see? And I can't pronounce it. What was the African lute players?
Basiku
Coyote, yes.
It was funny because I was sitting at the soundboard watching them deal with them, and then they had to switch over and do Original P. And that alone, that alone, watching those sound guys feverishly try to get this together with Original P just sort of falling all over.
You know, I'm glad you said that because the people behind the scenes are sometimes as artistic as the ones on the stage. The crew is just amazing what they do.
I don't know how they did it. I mean, you have to change all the sound levels. You go from this.
And they are so quick.
It's amazing.
It's unreal.
And it's the most pristine sound you'll hear inside, outside, anywhere.
Right. I have to say that Original P show, I have never been at a show in Richmond that looked as much like Richmond. I mean, there were old people, young people, just about every minority group, and they were absolutely going crazy together.
Sort of the vision of the festival from the very beginning, really.
Right, you know? Right.
Well, Punch and Judy was great, too, because I was talking to his son. I was wearing my Kiss shirt, and he loved it. So I ended up talking Kiss with the puppeteer and his son for a good 15 minutes and the correlation between what he does and what Kiss does.
Right.
Not unrelated at all.
It was very funny.
Lisa, you're the deputy director at Venture Richmond and also the Folk Festival. Some basic stats. You said 200,000 people attended the festival last year?
Yes, 200,000 people.
Wow.
Suddenly, we were the largest folk festival in the country, and that was something that the National Council for the Traditional Arts let us know. As soon as we were able to determine the number of bodies that we had on site. Certainly, as you already said, the weather, I mean, you know, we sort of joked that we could probably stand out there and spin plates in that kind of weather and people would come, but 200,000 people wouldn't come.
Right.
And they wouldn't have that much fun. We also collected $90,000 from the community in our bucket brigade, which I think is another impressive stat. It's taken us a while to get our Bucket Brigade up to the level that we would like for it to be, and that other some other folk festivals that we know about that they've been at for a number of years.
Now, the Bucket Brigade, that's the donations that the public yes. makes at the festival.
Absolutely. The orange buckets, hundreds of volunteers walking around with those orange buckets and passing them through the crowds like mm-hmm. a church offering plate, if you will. And we encourage people to give $5 a day per adult if they can.
But even if everyone gave a dollar, that would be $200,000.
It would be $200,000. Which
even I can do that math.
Right, sure. Right. So, I mean, you know, stage sponsorships are not inexpensive, and that's what keeps the festival free, are all of our sponsors. So we like to think that the community is actually sponsoring a stage when they step up to that level.
Now, will there be the same number of stages and musical acts this year?
Yes. 7 stages again, the Virginia Folklife area, 30 food vendors, the mm-hmm. crafts marketplace. So it will be the same this year as it has been in the past. We haven't had to cut back, which is pretty phenomenal. Well,
that's great. Stephen, you're the festival manager. What can you give me a short answer on this? What exactly does it take for you all to pull off this massive 3-day event? What
I wish I could give you a short answer, but it's a lot of work with a lot of great folks here in the community. It's everything from setting up, obviously, your stages and your sound and security and soda sales, and it's a massive undertaking. But obviously, as years have gone by, and now us being in our 5th Richmond Folk Festival, it seems to get a little easier for folks each year. But again, the weather is key. If we have pretty weather, we'll have those folks out there.
And you were saying that you're still looking for volunteers.
We are definitely looking for volunteers.
Where would people go to volunteer for the Folk Festival?
You would want to go to richmondfolkfestival.org. We have a tab there that says volunteer. It's very easy to fill out. Specifically right now, we're looking for folks to help out with our green team, mm-hmm. which is sponsored by VCU. This is an area on site that helps keep everything clean and nice. We get many comments from patrons who say the festival grounds are one of the cleanest they've seen at any event they go to, and that is partly because of this green team volunteer group we have.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can we talk about the music now? Music
Please.
Coming to the 2012 Richmond Folk Festival. People seem to be almost giddy about the schedule. I'd like each of you to give me the one act you're looking most forward to at this year's festival, and I guess I'll ask the chairman, Jim Wark, what his pick is.
Sure. Well, I'll already break your rule because I'm going to talk about two.
Don't.
Sorry. But I'll be brief. It's easy to say Roseanne Cash I'm looking forward to. Of course I am. Ralph Stanley, Junior Sisk, a lot of names that people actually do know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But every year there's just something that is so weird and so strange. That's what is always my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the very first year when we were still the National
Folk Festival. Like the throat singer.
Well, that was it. The first year, it was an incredible slate, but there was this one group that no one knew a thing about, the Altakai, mm-hmm. the throat singers from Nepal. And within, you know, their first performance, it became the talk of the festival. Just through the whole, it just spread like wildfire. This year, I have two candidates for the strangest, weirdest thing, which will be the thing I remember most. Mm. Joshua Nelson.
Yes.
Kosher Gospel.
Kosher Gospel is here in Richmond.
I say to you, Mazel Tov and hallelujah. this is a Jewish gentleman who was given a Mahalia Jackson record as a boy mm-hmm. and fell in love with the music. He is an African-American, Jewish-American, mm-hmm. who plays gospel music with Jewish lyrics. But I think he's going to get a run for his money because the other thing I can't wait to see is Wang Li, who is a jaw harp virtuoso, mm-hmm. which is an instrument that doesn't really, you wouldn't think, present itself for virtuosity. Now that I've cited these two people as the people I think are going to compete for that weirdness prize,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure it will actually be somebody else that I haven't even considered that will catch my eye and ear that way.
Like last year, I think the Punch and Judy show kind of took me by surprise,
right.
and I had to catch that twice. That was so great.
Yep.
Chris Bobst, what's your pick for this year?
Well, it's actually, I've had them before play. They play with a Debo band when they came through town. It's the dance troupe Fendeka from Ethiopia. I can't remember the male dancer's name, but I've never in my life seen anybody move like that. I was standing with probably, or I was standing in a room full of people. The people around me, everybody's face. There's a great picture of it where we're just our mouths wide open. We couldn't believe. I thought he was going to shake out of existence, spontaneously combust.
Right.
Wow.
And the music's really hypnotic, but trance-inducing melodies.
And how do you say it? Fendeka?
Fendeka.
Fendeka. Lisa, what's your choice?
Oh, gosh. It's like picking your favorite child. Mm-hmm. You know, we all say that, but it's true.
We all have one favorite child.
Right? Yes, we do. We just don't tell them. You know, and we don't talk about it on the radio. No.
You mean I wasn't loved equally? That's what I was told.
You know, I'm really looking forward, as I always do, to the Virginia Folklife area. You know, of course, our state folklorist, John Lohman, curates that area for us. And this year, the performance area, he'll be honoring all the National Heritage Fellows. These are people that the National Endowment for the Arts every year chooses to be to receive the highest honor in traditional arts. 13 of those individuals are from Virginia, which is a pretty high number for any state. So
we're pretty prestigious names there too.
Very prestigious, and we are you know, we're some of them are getting up in years, and so we wanted to try and honor them while we still have the opportunity. So that is going to be awesome. The people who are who have already passed will be, there will be tributes by people who are either in their family.
For instance,
or,
John Cephas, right?
Correct. Or, you know, Jeanette Carter, who's passed, Dale Jett, and Hello Stranger will be performing her song. So I'm really looking forward to that entire showcase in the Folklife area. And then I'm also, not to, you know, copy Jim, but I'm looking forward to Roseanne.
They told me that he did not love me. I could not believe it was true.
Roseanne Cash is, I'm a Nashville girl, and Johnny Cash is, you know, is one of my all-time favorites. So his daughter and how she sort of blends genres of music to make her own type of music. And then her, you know, her album, her recent album that's based on the list that her dad gave her of the 100 country songs you have to know if you're going to be a real country artist. I think she'll be playing from those. So I'm looking forward to
now that was that was a kind of a coup for the festival. She actually reached out to the festival.
Well, she reached out to Children Incorporated, which is a local charity with a kind of low profile, but who does fabulous work. And this is her 25th year of donating to Children Incorporated, headquartered right here in Richmond. And she said, "What can I do to help you in my 25th year?" And they said, "Well, you know, it would be great if you could come here." And she said, "Okay." And then I think her manager probably said, "Is there any place else that might be larger instead of kind of a private gala where she could perform?" Yeah. So Children Inc. reached out to us, and it was, I mean, we were very honored that they would think of us as a local partner, and then honored that she would want to play at the festival.
Now,
as
this
well.
Is kind of a special thing in that she's only going to play one show at the
it
festival.
It is,
and that's,
yes.
What day, Saturday?
It's Saturday at 1 o'clock on the Altria stage. And she's, you know, we don't have headliners at the Folk Festival. We don't like to talk about headliners. We like to talk about the you know, the greatest artist you've never heard of.
Yeah, it's an experience, a total experience.
It is, correct. But this is special, and we just felt that we couldn't pass it up, and we're really thrilled.
Stephen, what's your pick?
For me, it's all about the funk. On Saturday night at the dance tent, we generally like to have either a go-go band or a funk band, and this year we are not going to disappoint with Fred Wesley and the New JBs.
That's the original stuff.
It's
there's
great.
Your pedigree right there.
Yeah.
They're not known for their funkiness.
No, they're not so great. And then this man's played with everybody from obviously James Brown to Van Morrison and P-Funk and De La Soul. I mean, it's a very long list of amazing performers he's played with, and he will have a killer band playing with him. It's from what I have seen of recent performances online on YouTube. It's funky. It's not It's not terribly jazzy, which would be a lot of fun.
Well, there's always a very, like a kind of a shroud of academia that hovers over the programming of this festival. There's specific criteria.
Oh, we're more fun than that.
Well, but that's kind of my point. That's where I'm going, because it can be both, you know.
Yeah.
We look for artists that, you know, are playing indigenous music that's passed on through generation. There, you know, there's certain criteria. You know, singer-songwriters, that's really not what the folk festival is mm-hmm. all about, which mm-hmm. is kind of a anomaly to some people. But just sometimes, you know, you can be traditional in a Smithsonian way, and you can still be all about shaking the booty.
Well, one I'm looking forward to is Rahim Al-Haj. I think I'm saying that right. He's the master of the oud. The oud has just the most haunting sound. It's like an Arabian lute. And the musician's own personal story is very compelling, too. Can anyone talk about the festival's relationship with the National Council for the Traditional Arts, who helped the festival in booking?
Well, yeah, Stephen and I work with them an awful lot. Well, the programming committee does too, of course. Mm-hmm. They are kind of the curators, if you will. They help us. They help. I don't know. Keep us grounded. They help us understand
yes.
really what we're talking about when we're talking about yeah. real traditional arts.
Mm-hmm. And they establish that with the National, but then the programming committee, you know, we very consciously decided, you know, when the festival became our own mm-hmm. After the 3 years of the National, you know, we actually voted. You know, we
right.
very seriously said we want to follow the same criteria.
Yeah.
So they have set the parameters, and we voluntarily accepted them. But
right.
Yeah.
Well, in 2003, we actually bid on the National Folk Festival,
mm-hmm.
And it's owned by the NCTA, and they decided to bring it here in 2005, 6, and 7. And we did, as Jim says, made a very conscious decision, both in terms of our volunteers on the programming committee and staff, that we were going to follow the same model. So we still work with them. They do a lot. They do other folk festivals. They mm-hmm. do tours. They're involved in a lot of different traditional arts efforts across the country. So they're able to reach out to people that we would not normally maybe have a lot of contact with. So they are very important in a lot of ways, their relationships, and then also their expertise and their knowledge.
And they're also really important in that they really listen to the programming committee.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, we trust them, but they trust us.
Mm-hmm.
They help provide us some on-site staff. We have a small staff at Venture Richmond, a group of four that's on our events team. So we certainly need some assistance. It's been great getting to work with them.
Well, it's a well-seasoned working relationship. This is the fifth Richmond Folk Festival, but actually it's the eighth folk festival if you count the previous National Folk
that's
Festival.
That's correct. And a lot of these folks we're working with have been doing this for 40 and 50 years.
We have become, I think it's safe to say that Richmond has become the folk festival that the National Council for Traditional Arts, the one that they're most proud.
I'm sure they love all their festivals equally.
Yeah,
they just love us a little more equally, that's all.
Yeah.
There's a Cindy, there's a Jan, there's a Marcia.
I just hope 1 year we get Nickelback in there. I mean, I've been pushing this.
We're gonna edit that out.
You are listening to Open Source RVA on WRIR, and I'm speaking with Lisa Sims and Stephen Leckie from Venture Richmond, also Jim Wark and Chris Bopes. They are from the Richmond Folk Festival Programming Committee. We're talking about this year's festival, which kicks off October 12th. John Lohman from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities always does an incredible job with the Virginia Folklife Stage. Speak to that tradition. That's actually something that people really look forward to every year.
There is one section of the festival that is curated by this gentleman you mentioned, John Lohman, who's, I wonder if our listeners know that they have a state folklorist. I didn't know before I got involved in this.
Right.
His name's John Lohman.
And
he's amazing.
And they made a very good choice. They did.
What's the slogan for this year? Can we give that out yet, or is it?
Absolutely. There's a popular area for the last 2 years have been an oyster shucking contest between the Pratt sisters, I believe is their last name, and they've got a fine history of being the best oyster shuckers on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had
very competitive.
Very
systems.
Competitive.
Yes.
And they've had a split decision the last 2 years. Each one of them has won, and this year is the final showdown, and I believe it's called the...
What is
settling
it?
The score
in
the
804.
Oh, okay.
Bingo, that's it.
Well, and that's a good example. What John does is first he does put together a musical program And, you know, has his own stage to
do that. Right, because there's actually two programs, right? There's the arts and crafts.
Right. And we've talked about the music is themed this year. It's always themed. Mm-hmm. And this year it's the National Heritage Fellowship winners. And then he'll put together a group of, I'll call them performances, you know, demonstrations of different crafts and different traditions. And the oyster shucking is... Mm-hmm. It's the perfect example. It's what's more Virginian than oyster shucking.
And this year there's going to be foodways, but not in the traditional sense. Foodways as in sort of industries that are around food.
We'll have a moonshine still on site.
Oh, which, nice.
Right.
Really are working? Much,
well, we actually have one of those every year, but we don't tell.
Only for the children.
Yeah. That's just for the programming committee.
Right, right. Shh,
we should also point out, though, that the Folk Life area really, well, every state that hosts a national has its own state sort of area. Mm-hmm. They call it material culture. We call it the Folk Life area because we happen to have a state folklorist, and John does this very well. But ours is certainly the most robust of any area.
It's a festival on its own. You just stay right there.
And then the family area that we have, mm-hmm, is also just an amazing family area, and it's completely produced independently by the Children's Museum of Richmond. Mm-hmm. So those are two producing partners in addition to the NCTA who really help us, you know, sort of rise above other festivals.
Right,
two areas are could be independent events, mm-hmm, on their own.
Everyone that's listening knows exactly what we mean, but if you have never been to the festival, any one of these seven stages would be an amazing day, would be an amazing show. At the festival, when we start talking about all the different kind of musics and the artists we want to bring in, we always end up referring to this as an embarrassment of riches, and it really is. There's nothing like it.
Well, can we start talking about how we select the acts that are chosen for the festival? I'm looking at you, Jim.
Okay.
As the chairman of the
committee. Still haven't had polka yet, though.
Well, yes, we have. There's been two kinds of music I've been insisting on, polka, and we did have polka. We had some great polka out of Texas,
right,
has a great Slavic and Polish tradition, mm-hmm, in Texas. But more to the process, it is really interesting. When it was the national, there's no question the NCTA comes in and they're calling the shots. But one of the things that they insist upon is a local programming committee.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know from other festivals and from other efforts that very often these programming committees end up being really kind of like maybe administrators in the arts and sort of like kind of like a plum ceremony. It's more ceremonial. Yeah, it truly is. But I'll give my props to Venture Richmond, because whether you meant to or not, well, they formed the programming committee, and I was lucky enough, mm-hmm, to be asked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I kind of invited Chris and you, Don, mm-hmm, in after a couple of years. They put together this committee that was made up of, yes, academicians, you know, like Greg.
Greg Kimball.
Greg Kimball at the Library of Virginia, and some arts administrators. But we also plucked, you know, people from the bar scene, musicians.
Right. The musicologists.
The bar musicologists.
Yeah,
you know, the people that have really been in
like
the trenches.
You.
Like me, and like Chuck Wren, mm-hmm, and people like Jimmy Bland. And, you know, people that are, you know, don't just like observe the scene, but create the scene. They're part of the scene. And so we had this group together, and people like, you know, our dear departed friends, Gary Gerloff, Paige Wilson.
Right.
People who are creating the scene, not trying to regulate the scene.
Yes.
Or certainly not to benefit from the scene, other than the artistry that they're anyway. This group came together, and it is so disparate and amazing that to be at one of these meetings, it's the only 4-hour meeting that every single person in the room looks forward to. I can guarantee you all agree.
Absolutely.
I can guarantee you that. And the way we formulate the programming, it's not that much different than when it was the national. We're a little more forceful in our, mm-hmm, opinions.
We're a little more proactive.
But proactive. We're also a lot more experienced at doing it now. Mm-hmm. But we usually start with talking about different genres of music,
mm-hmm,
and then start talking about different artists within those genres.
Right.
The NCTA curators do the actual booking. So what we'll do is, within a genre that we know we want to bring every year, we will listen to artists and we'll suggest artists, and NCTA brings lots.
It's sort of like jukebox jury in many ways.
It really is, because we listen and then we vote. We prioritize artists that we want to bring in with a genre.
Hey, talk a little bit about some of the satellite events, like the outreach to local schools.
Well, gosh, we usually do visits to 10 to 15 local schools. I mean, we know not everybody is going to get down to the festival, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We'd like it if they could, but frankly, you know, the site couldn't hold everybody in the region. So we try to get some artists to come in a day early, and with the help of Jam Inc., speaking of Tim Timberlake, volunteers every year to sort of coordinate with the schools and get into, whether it's elementary, middle, high, it doesn't really matter, who express an interest, and we go into the schools and they perform. So, you know, we generally are reaching a few thousand students every year just by taking the Folk Festival on the road locally.
Right. Chris, any other thoughts as we look ahead to the festival?
One year I want to get LKJ. That's what I'm going to. Lynn Keezy Johnson, you know.
Absolutely. That'd be awesome.
Apparently he's still playing and he's still good. That was my suggestion.
Well, you have to show the patience of Jim Wark
on the doo-wop. I said it after Nickelback, and then no one listened to
no
me.
One's
is
listening.
He in well, Nickelback? Does he play in the band?
That would be awesome.
That could be for one of the 10.
So we're starting the programming next year's programming session now. So I'm telling everybody
okay.
here.
Okay, we're on high alert.
And I think we can't stop until we remind everybody, and I think surely people know by now, but we hear this a lot still. That, you know, it's not banjos and quilts. The folk festival is the music of the people, literally folk music. Mm-hmm. It's not Peter, Paul, and Mary, or you know, and it's not banjos and quilts. It's all genres of traditional music. So, yeah, just want to make sure people understand that.
Well, you've been listening to Open Source RVA on WRIR, and I've been speaking with Lisa Sims and Stephen Leckie from Venture Richmond, and also Jim Wark and Chris Bopes. They're members of the Richmond Folk Festival Programming Committee. Thanks for coming, guys.
Thanks for having us.
And you're listening to WRIR LP 97.3 FM Richmond. And now for a Rainbow Minute.
And I'm Chris Dovey, co-host of Open Source, and I want to thank you all for listening to Rainbow Minute and to Open Source today. Quality local produced shows like these aren't possible without your support, but also they require great underwriters like Haberdasher Corporate Apparel. Broadcast of WRIR is sponsored in part by Haberdasher Corporate Apparel, a locally owned SWAM, SWAM certified, woman-owned business providing uniforms, logo, apparel, T-shirts and promotional products to businesses, schools, and nonprofits in Virginia and the Mid-Atlantic region. More about Haberdasher can be found on Facebook and the web at haberdashercorporateapparel.com or by calling 804-878-7630. Thank you, Haberdasher. And before we go, I'm here with author and activist Larry Yates. Mr. Yates recently wrote a letter to Governor Bob McDonald extending an invitation to attend an event on the state capitol grounds. The governor, unfortunately, will be unable to attend this Monday as Yates attaches a toy arrow to the foot of the statue of segregationist former U.S. Senator Harry Flood Byrd. Yates, again, who's with us today, received a letter from the governor's office extending, quote, best wishes for a successful event. Mr. Yates, do you think the governor might maybe send an official delegation from the Capitol Police to meet you?
Well, at the Capitol, I've been talking to the Capitol Police. I'm sure they will be there. The governor's office also extended an invitation to invite somebody from the cabinet, so I did invite the Secretary of Natural Resources. I haven't heard from that person for some reason.
Now, the purpose of your protest?
Well, this is really about questioning the dignity and really the appropriateness of having a statue of Harry Flood Byrd in our state capitol. I'm not about organizing taking down the statue, but I think people just need to look at the fact that this was a guy whose last hurrah was trying to block the Supreme Court's Brown versus Board desegregation decision. That's not what most people in Virginia believe now, and I just want to point that out.
All right, and that's it. Thank you very much, Mr. Yates, for talking to us today. And you have a couple of books coming out. They're going to be...
The Scalawag Scholar's Notes on Virginia and Bloodroot Cantons, both on sale on Amazon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Yates.
Thank you.